so I know she's heard me. I forgot to tell you. I'll call Mom to let her know. I add hesitantly. When Annie shakes her head, I say softly, Annie, she needs to know. I'm insistent, even though I know the conversation is not going to be a fun one. Surprise, Annie just had a baby. Oh, and she's been charged with child endangerment, and she's going into court-ordered rehab in 7 days. If that doesn't work, she's probably off to jail for a decade. So that's our news. How's the weather over there? She's going to be so pissed. I'll deal with her. Do you think she will come? I honestly don't know. Do you want her to come? Annie thinks about it for a while before she shakes her head. I don't want her to see me like this. Well, if it's any consolation, she'll only come if Robert lets her. Annie finally looks at me, and we share a sad smile. I turn back to the doorway, then ask, Is there anyone else I should call? You think I'm pathetic, don't you? Her sharp tone seems to come out of nowhere. I look to Annie, confused. Don't, Annie. I'm just trying to help. I have a feeling that seeing me like this is probably satisfying to you, Annie says bitterly. Did you just know that one day I'd come begging you for help again? It's probably killed you that it's taken 2 years. She can be so mean, so condescending, and I'm so tired. The day has been emotionally exhausting, a roller coaster that seemed to be winding its way toward a peaceful rest, until now. I want to get out of the room before things deteriorate further, so I take a hasty step toward the door. I'll be back in the morning. I'll bring you some things. Some breakfast again? Don't fucking bother! I don't need your charity! I open the door, but I hesitate before I step out. And the impulse to bite back is too strong. I ignore the weariness on her face and the pain in her eyes as I whisper bitterly, If you really don't need my charity, I'll have the hospital send you the bill for your care then, shall I? And the lawyer. And the rehab clinic. I step out of her room before she can reply, although I know it's unfair of me. I don't understand why she does that, why she has to push me away. What more could I possibly do for her than I've already done in the last few days? What more can she possibly expect from me?
Ready to go?
Sam approaches me and I nod.
Are you okay? You're flushed.
Just ready to get out of here, I mutter, reluctant to tell him about Annie's little mood swing. I'm concerned about how he'll react. He'll either storm into her room and tell her off, or justify her behavior by pointing out that she's just had a baby, and her hormones are all over the place, she's in significant pain, and she's probably terrified. I'm not sure which would annoy me more, so I keep my mouth shut. As soon as we get home, I walk right into our bedroom to make the call to Mom. Robert answers, his voice gruff and abrupt.
Hello.
Hello, Robert. This is Alexis. Please, can I speak with my mother? Ever since I had to call them to beg for money the first time Annie needed to go to private rehab, he's allowed us relatively easy access to Mom over the phone. I have no idea why. I'll never know for sure, but I suspect his surprise lenience with the rules is because he feels guilty for how hard he was on Annie when she was a kid. Robert doesn't respond to my request, but this is pretty typical. On the rare occasions that I call, he doesn't waste time with small talk. Instead, I hear muffled sounds, and then my mother's voice comes through the line.
Oh, hello, Lexi.
She greets me, and she sounds delighted, as she always does when I call.
It's so nice to hear from you.
I'm startled by the nervous butterflies in my stomach. For a moment, I actually think I'm going to lose my nerve. I clear my throat and pick up Sam's pillow, then cuddle it close against my chest. Hi, Mom, I say. Listen, something has happened with Annie. She's okay, but I don't know how.
Is everything okay?
Mom asks, and I hear the mounting concern in her voice. Mom loves us. I know Annie has her doubts, but I don't. The decisions Mom has made, even the questionable ones, have all been because she thought she was doing the right thing at the time. Annie had a baby today, Mom.
A what?
It's a girl. Her name is Daisy Nell. I let Mom digest this, but she's silent for a long time. I press my face into Sam's pillow and inhale deeply, but the moment stretches, and eventually I prompt, Mom, are you okay?
I'm fine, Mom says stiffly. I'm confused, but I'm fine. I spoke to her 2 weeks ago and she didn't mention a baby. She said she was busy with work.
Work? I repeat blankly. I'm not really sure about that, Mom. She thought she could clean up her act before she told you, but she got sick, and the baby had to come early. Annie has still been using drugs, so Daisy will probably have to go through withdrawals over the next few weeks. I know I'm giving Mom a lot of shocking news all at once, so I try to soften it a little as I add, but she should be fine eventually, too.
Oh. Oh, no. Annie, no.
Mom whispers. Her voice is thickening. She's near tears, and suddenly I am, too.
How has it come to this, Lexi?
She has a problem, Mom.
She needs to get herself right with the Lord.
She needs to get herself right with herself, Mom. I sigh impatiently. Look, I just wanted to let you know. The thing is, the police and Child Protective Services are involved because she had a positive drug test at the hospital. She's been charged because she used drugs while she was pregnant. So now she has to go to rehab next week.
Rehab is good.
You just have to help her stop now, Lexi. She's got a child now, Mom says. This is simple to her. I just need to sort Annie out so she can be a good mom. To my mother, this is a moral failure, not an illness, and it's one that Mom sees as transferable. I'm more responsible than Annie, so I can solve this if I just apply myself. It's nothing new, but it's maddening. She can't just stop. If she could stop, she would have stopped years ago. She's an addict, for God's sake.
Please don't speak like that, Alexis. You know it upsets me.
What upsets me is watching my sister waste her life to this addiction, Mom. I'm frustrated, and I'm tired, and I just want you to understand what a complete mess this is. Annie is going to rehab next week without her baby. The baby will stay with me until she's released, in 3 months' time. Do you understand that?
So what do you want me to do? You know I can't come.
Mom is whispering now. I imagine Robert has come closer again, and I know she's going to wrap the call up even before she does.
Well, thank you for letting me know. We will have the church family pray for her.
Mom, please at least talk to Robert about coming over to support Annie, please.
You know that Robert and I believe Annie needs to resolve her issues on her own. She has made the decision to walk away from her faith, and don't you even want to see your granddaughter?
I would really appreciate it if you could find a way to send a photo to me, Alexis. Truly, it would mean the world, Mom says stiffly.
And of course, please keep me informed if anything changes.
I'm going to go before I say something I regret, I choke as tears fill my eyes. It still stings that my mother would choose Robert and the church over Annie and me time and time again.
How did it go?
Sam asks me as I come down the stairs into our living area. He offers me a very full glass of wine, and I accept it gratefully.
It went exactly as I knew it would, I mutter blithely as I curl up on the couch.
She'd probably jump on a plane and come down to see the baby if Robert would let her, but he won't, so she's happy to leave all of this mess to me.
Sam sits beside me, then pulls me gently against him and wraps his arm around my shoulders.
I lean into him and release a frustrated sigh.
God, you're going to run screaming away from me when you realize how messed up my family is.
You did warn me it's all a bit messy, he
he says.
A bit? It is what it is, Lex. We'll manage.
I close my eyes and let myself sink into the moment. It's peaceful in our house, even more so in Sam's arms, and I gradually start to relax.
She's beautiful, isn't she?
Sam murmurs sometime later. Daisy?
Yeah.
I smile softly and nod.
Yeah. She really is.
18. Annie. Luke. I almost brought this journal with me to our session yesterday, but then I lost my nerve. I'm a coward. I don't want you to ask me about Robert. I'm scared that if I hear you say his name, I'll lose my mind. Let's see if I can write this down. I've never said it aloud. No one knows. No one in the world except for Robert and me. It's a secret we share that binds us. That's part of the problem. I'm bound to the only person on earth whom I hate more than I hate myself. At least when Lexi was around, I had someone around me who wasn't completely sold on the extremism in the community. She and I could giggle over the ludicrousness of some of the rules, or point out the imbalance between the way the men behaved and were treated, and the way us lesser mortals, the women, were expected to behave. But once Lexi was gone, I was on my own. People were constantly reminding me of my own sinfulness, of my disgrace and my moral failure for not managing to fit in. Those voices took up residence in my mind. And so the acts of rebellion, the pull towards self-expression that I'd always felt, the stubborn insistence that I needed to find a way to be different, those things became less about asserting myself and more about being who I was gradually coming to believe I was. Bad, different, sinful, tainted. The louder those voices grew inside my mind, the worse my behavior became, and the harder Robert clamped down on me, the more determined I was to find a way to break free. As my behavior escalated, Robert's punishments morphed from strict to sadistic. And then Lexi left, and the loss of control seemed to send him a little mad. In the days after her birthday, he locked me in my room for 4 days without food so that I could fast to atone for my sins. And when that didn't work, he told me I wasn't even allowed to go to school until I sought the Lord's forgiveness. I didn't enjoy going to school, but it was at least an escape from our house. When Robert banned me from going, the consequence was complete and utter isolation. And because I was alone, I was more vulnerable than I had ever been before. The first time it happened, I woke up the next day and convinced myself that it had been a nightmare. I was furious with myself for imagining such a disgusting thing. Wasn't this still more evidence of my sinfulness? It was difficult to convince myself to ignore the physical signs that my nightmare had been real. But I was 12 years old. Denial was a much safer option than facing the reality of what he'd done. But after that first night, I found it so hard to fall asleep, and I was wide awake the next time he came, awake enough to fight, awake enough to hear his threats and justifications. You deserve this, you filthy little slut. This is all that you are good for. If you tell your mother, I'll throw you both out. Do you understand that? Where would you even go? If I had already started to fall victim to the voices that said I was bad, once Robert started coming to my room at night, I believed wholeheartedly in every self-deprecating cry that crossed my mind. Now I had evidence. He was strict, but everyone in the community revered him as a good, God-fearing man. Why would he hurt me like that if I wasn't already damaged in some way? I blamed myself. I had been causing him grief for years. Clearly, I deserved what he was doing to me. And then there was Mom. She had already lost one husband, and if I told her, she'd surely leave Robert immediately and then she'd sink back into that shell. Her smile would disappear again. There were practical considerations, too. Lexi used to remind me that Mom had sold the house and signed Dad's pension over to Robert, so we'd be cast out, and we'd have nothing. So for my final 2 years in the community, I became a model citizen. I grew my hair and I even stopped braiding it. I wore it long down my back, just the way all of the other women did. I wore the headscarf and I went to services and I did my schoolwork and I read the Bible in the afternoons like I was supposed to. If he had set out to break my spirit, Robert finally found a way to do it. It didn't stop his visits at night, but conforming meant that at least Mom was proud of me again. And I hated him, and I hate him. And every second that I was there and I saw the triumph in his eyes as I finally gave in and complied with the stupid rules of that place, I hated him more, until that hate became part of who I am. People who have never had cause to hate do not understand how it stains you. Hating for the very first time is black dye seeping into white fabric. You can scrub and scrub and scrub and wash and wash and wash, but there will always be a stain, the fabric forever changed. And if it is long enough to fester, hate stops feeling like anger or rage, and it feels only like pain. If you had asked me before we moved to the community, when we were at that big house in the suburbs with a beautiful flowering agapanthus on the path, "Who are you, Annie?" I would have said that I was the daughter of Neil and Deborah Vidler, and that my father was a hero, and that my mother nurtured as easily as she breathed. I'd have told you about my brilliantly clever big sister, and I'd have told you that one day I was going to write a book, and until then I was going to read and read and read and live every adventure that life offered me. I left the community when I was 14, right at dawn so I didn't cause a fuss, just like Lexi did. I didn't leave because I was old enough to leave. I left because my period had started, and I was terrified I would become pregnant if I stayed. I left because I had to, and I left because I figured that no one would bother to follow me. They all knew that I wasn't worth saving. I left with a broken spirit and an irrevocably damaged soul. And as I walked away from those gates that day, if you had asked me who I was, I'd have told you that I was a sinner, a girl who had been used because that was what she deserved. Someone who cost her family its happiness. Someone who cost herself her soul.
19. Lexi. When I arrive at the hospital the next day, I find my sister sitting up in the chair by the window with her daughter in her arms. She barely moves when I open the door. Her gaze is fixed on Daisy, and I'm anxious that I might be interrupting a private moment between my sister and her daughter. I hesitate and almost leave the room to give her privacy, but as I take my first step back, she looks up. Annie smiles at me, a serene, proud smile. She's a completely different person today. "Hey," she whispers, "come on in." Despite the rough farewell we had the night before, I asked Sam to stop on the way into the hospital so I could pick up coffees and more sweet treats for Annie. I set all the gifts on the bed and approached the chair. "She's so perfect," Annie whispers, awestruck. "I can't believe how much I love her. There's nothing I wouldn't do for her. No one told me it would feel like this." "I'm amazed you're already out of bed. Are you feeling okay?" I ask gently, and I sit very carefully on the arm of her chair. I still feel like I'm interrupting, but then Annie angles the baby toward me and very gently slides her into my arms. Suddenly, this isn't their moment. It's ours. As I nestle Daisy against myself, an involuntary smile crosses my face. "Hi there, Daisy." "I'm actually feeling okay," Annie says. "I thought I was going to die when they made me get out of bed, but I took a shower, so I'm feeling even better now. And I slept like a log last night, but the nurses woke me up a few times so I could try to give her the colostrum." "So you decided to breastfeed her after all?" "For the next few days, yeah. That hurts too, but they said it'll help her with sucking and stuff, so I'll make it work." She clears her throat and says, "I'm going to be okay, you know?" "Of course you are," I say. "And this little one? Well, I think she might be the most beautiful baby I've ever seen." "I thought that too," Annie says. "I thought the hormones had made me blind. She could have two heads, and I don't think I noticed this morning." We both laugh softly, and then I press my forefinger against Daisy's palm. Her fingers contract too stiffly around mine, and I wonder about her muscle tone. "Do you know what her NAS scores have been?" I ask Annie.
They were great yesterday. 3 and 4, I think they said. But this morning was 7, and a while ago it was 9. They set her for scores over 8 for 3 checks in a row. They'll medicate her. I know it's pretty much inevitable. Some babies skip it, but it's pretty unlikely. I know. And I know I've already asked a lot, but I'm really gonna need your help, Lexi. Anything, Annie. I promise her, and she bites her lip. I need to go to rehab, and I need to make it work this time. I know. I tried all of the other times, I really did. But this time she needs me. I think that will make a difference. I've never loved anything in this life as much as I love that baby. I'm going to make this work. I'm going to give her a better life. I have to. I can see the determination in Annie's eyes again, and I'm comforted by it. It's funny, because I've always seen the potential in her. It was there all along, buried under a pile of chaos, hidden from the world. But I caught just enough glimpses of it to keep on believing in her, at least on some level. This is another peek at a future that I have always seen in my mind, another glimpse of the woman whom I have always believed in. I haven't put up with Annie's shenanigans for all these years because I'm an idiot. I've put up with them because I just couldn't give up on the person I knew she could be. We stare down at the baby together for a moment. And then I glance at my sister again, and I whisper, "Whatever you need, Annie. Anything you need." Tuesday is a nice day, a peaceful day. Annie is content, and Daisy is well. But that brief glimpse of peacefulness is gone by the time I arrive at the hospital the next morning. A nurse directs me to the NICU, where I find Annie in a silent, dark room off the main nursery. She's rocking in a rocking chair, and Daisy is in her arms. The baby's cry is weak, but high-pitched, the kind of cry that hurts to hear. "Hi, Annie," I whisper as I enter the room. I notice the tray of breakfast that sits untouched beside her. Annie looks up at me, and her face is streaked with tears. Her NAS scores were too high. They started her on morphine last night, but she's still unsettled this morning. I lift a piece of toast and bring it near Annie's face. She looks at me incredulously. "I'll eat when she settles," she whispers, and she stares down at her daughter again. Yesterday, I kind of thought that she was going to be okay, but last night, her whole body was shaking, and she broke out in a rash, and she wouldn't drink. And then she wouldn't stop crying. She went all floppy, and then she was too stiff, and it was just... Annie shudders, then pulls the baby right up against her cheek. "I can't even explain to you how much withdrawal hurts, to know that I have put my own baby through this. I don't know how I can live with myself." "You're going to live with yourself by doing better," I say firmly. "You are going to focus on being the best mom you can be from now on." "Is mom coming down?" Annie asks. Her voice is tiny, like she's a child again. We didn't talk about mom yesterday. I didn't bring it up, and Annie didn't ask. I hesitate before I admit. "I don't think so. She wants me to send her a photo." "Don't you fucking hate her sometimes, Lexi?" Annie sighs. "Of course I do." I snort, and Annie releases a surprised giggle. "Is it any wonder the mess that I am?" "You've got some problems, but everyone has problems." "You don't," Annie says pointedly, and I grimace. "Of course I have problems. I just deal with mine in a different way." "A healthy way," Annie surmises, and I shake my head. "I don't know about that. I mean, yes, I have a career, and there's Sam, and we have a house now. My life looks good. It is good. But I make stupid decisions. God, I'm so used to controlling things that even when someone else is doing a cesarean on my sister, I want to take over." Annie laughs weakly. "Tell me about this house." And so I tell her. I tell her about the rambling house that Sam and I have purchased,
and the minor renovation that we are midway through. Even the address that seems so auspicious, 7 Neil Lane, like Dad himself had blessed it for us. I tell her how I'm getting the colors just right because we're going to repaint it, and how one day our kids will have bedrooms there, big bedrooms that they can share if they want to. I tell her about the agapanthus we are planting along the front path and the new weatherboard that we just had fixed to the exterior, dark gray with a bright white trim. I tell her about the huge attic and the office with the bay windows and the big bifold windows in the kitchen and the adorable guest house. I tell her about the parties Sam and I threw over the summer last year. The whole neighborhood came, and our block is teeming with kids. They climbed the trees and ate Sam's famous barbecue. Annie has always been the storyteller of the two of us, but today, telling her this story seems to be energizing her. Maybe I shouldn't paint this glowing picture of my life while hers is in ruins, but I can see the joy in her eyes from the distraction, and as Annie relaxes into our chat, Daisy seems to relax too. Eventually, she falls asleep. We sit in the dark room and talk until the nurse comes to do another NAS assessment. Come on, I tell Annie when the nurse takes the baby. Let's go get you some breakfast. I can eat this, she protests, but I shake my head. It's cold now. Daisy will be okay for a few minutes. We'll get something fresh, a muffin and some proper coffee from the cafeteria, okay? Annie shuffles out of the NICU, casting glances over her shoulder toward Daisy as we go. At the door to the main ward, she winces in pain, and I fetch her a wheelchair. As I push her along the hall, she reaches up to squeeze my hand against the chair handle, and she croaks unevenly. Lexi, will she be okay after all this? I know this is awful for us to watch, for the medical staff too, but studies show that long-term outcomes for NAS babies tend to be positive when all other factors are equalized. Translate that into English for me instead of doctor speak? Annie asks. I just want to know if I've ruined her for life. It means that once she's withdrawn, if she has a stable home and a healthy mother, she's going to be just fine. Annie nods and releases my hand. She raises her chin, and I see her straighten her spine. I'm not gonna fuck up this time. I know, love, I reassure her. And it's less than half a lie. I know. Hang on a second, Lexi, she murmurs, and I stop the chair cautiously, watching to see what she does. She pulls herself out of it with a wince, then walks around the chair to throw herself at me, wrapping her arms around my neck. I'm not expecting the embrace, and I startle a little, but she only tightens her grip. Thank you, Lexi, she whispers. And I wrap my arms around her skinny little frame and blink against the tears that have sprung into my eyes. She draws in a deep breath and relaxes the hug, then leans back to stare into my eyes. I think she's about to say something else profound, but a twinkle rises in her gaze, and for just a split second, I can see a mischievous, childlike quality in her again. What was that you were saying about coffee and donuts at the cafeteria for breakfast? She asks me. I think I said coffee and muffins. I laugh softly. I'm pretty sure a donut is just a muffin with a hole in the middle. Got a hankering for donuts this morning, huh? Every morning. Always. Return to your chariot then, madam, and we'll see what we can do. I tease her gently, and I help her back into the chair, then start the long walk down the hallway.
20. Annie. Luke. I had no idea where to find Lexi. If she had been writing to me, Robert had intercepted the letters, and if she'd called, no one had ever told me. But that was just as we expected when she left. By walking away, she was rejecting the church, and that meant those left behind were supposed to behave as if she'd died. but I knew my sister wouldn't have forgotten about me, just as certainly as I knew she'd have fallen on her feet when she got out into the real world. So I walked out of Winterton and toward Collinsville, and there wasn't a doubt in my mind that I'd find refuge with her. I had a small backpack with my most prized possessions, a photo of Dad in my journal. I had only the clothes I wore. I hadn't taken any others because I never wanted to wear them again. Every article in my wardrobe was a clear signal to anyone in the area around Winterton that I came from the village. I never wanted to be associated with a sect again. I wanted only to be free. And as I walked those first few miles, that's exactly how I felt. The air tasted different, and breathing felt easier, like my chest had been compressed and suddenly released. I laughed a few times, just because I was out of the house, and just because I was never going back. It was only as I reached the outskirts of Collinsville that the magnitude of my situation really hit me. I had no idea what Mom and Robert would even do. Maybe they would follow me. No one had gone after Lexi, but she'd been older, almost an adult. I'd never heard of a 14-year-old leaving Winterton before. The other children my age were different, almost robotic in their obedience. And if Robert did come for me, what would he do? The thought was terrifying. What punishment could he possibly inflict on me that was worse than the ones I'd suffered already? I'd been brave and excited, but soon I was shaking and sobbing, running along the road toward an unknown destination. I hid behind bushes when cars came from the direction of Winterton, and a sweeping paranoia came over me. I startled a flock of birds in a tree, and when they flew away, I heard the sound of footsteps and the flapping of their wings. Collinsville is a small place, and a distraught, half-crazed 14-year-old walking along the highway wasn't going to go unnoticed for long. A police car soon pulled up alongside me. Convinced Robert had sent them for me, I tried to run away. The officers caught me, and when they pinned me to the ground, I panicked all over again. "Hey, kids, settle down," one of the officers shouted, after the wild thrashing of my wrists almost caught his jaw. "We don't want to hurt you. What happened? Where are you going?"
"My sister," I sobbed. "I need to find my sister."
"You're from Winterton?" the other officer said, leaning over me warily. I shook my head, irrational in my fear. Of course they knew I was from Winterton. My clothes would have left them no doubt.
"Where is your sister?"
"I don't know," I admitted. And then I started to sob again. "Please don't make me go back. I can't go back. Please help me."
"If I release you, will you stop hitting me?" the first officer asked.
When I nodded, he slid off me and took my hand to help me up.
"Let's go to the station and figure something out."
"You're not going to take me back?" I asked. I let him pull me up to my feet, but I planted them hard. I was ready to run. I wasn't going anywhere near that car until they promised me.
"Right now, we're going to take you to the station so you can tell us what's going on. Then we'll make a plan, okay?"
At the station, I met a sympathetic female officer who made me hot cocoa and casually chatted with me about my situation. I gave her a heavily sanitized account of my issues at home. I focused only on what I figured would seem serious enough for them to let me stay away, but not bad enough to get anyone into any real trouble. I was also pretty sure I'd asked for the worst of it. Would they arrest me if I told them? I didn't want them to ask Robert about it, then come back and tell me in disgust that it was all my fault anyway. But mostly, I didn't want Mom to ever know, and so I kept my mouth shut. I felt I might be a terrible, wicked person, but at least I was good at keeping secrets. At the end of a very long, teary chat, the female officer agreed that she thought it was best for me to find Lexi. That just left the problem of how exactly to do that. All I had was Lexi's name, and the belief that she might have found her way to a university somewhere. The officer asked if I knew anyone else in Collinsville whom we could call. I racked my brain and came up blank, until it suddenly occurred to me that I did know someone. Someone I could walk across the road to speak with, actually. The fire station was there. Captain Edwards knew exactly where to find Lexi, because she lived in his basement for 12 months after she left Winterton. He and his wife had taken her in while she studied for the GED, and then started at community college and saved some money. She was now in her second year of a 4-year course at Chicago State, living in a dorm on campus, and Captain Edwards had her cell number. A cell phone. I'd never even seen one, and when Captain Winters first passed his phone to me, I had no idea what it was. I sobbed while I tried to explain to Lexi that I couldn't go back to the community, and once she got over the shock of the call, she was resolute. "Ask Captain Edwards if he can bring you here," she said firmly. "I'll take care of you." It wasn't as simple as that. There were legalities to sort out because of my age. The police officer had to call Robert and Mom, and while she never told me the details of the conversation, she told me that if I wanted to go to Lexi, I wouldn't be forced to return to Winterton. And so, 2 days after I walked away from Robert's home, Captain Edwards delivered me to Lexi. I was fragile, confused, and still scared. Every now and again, I'd start shaking for no reason, as if I were in shock. I kept expecting someone to tell me that Robert changed his mind and was coming to get me. And every time Captain Edwards' phone rang, I'd feel adrenaline surge all the way through my body. But there were no last-minute disasters, no more drama to contend with. And when I finally walked into Lexi's room, she was sobbing. We held each other and cried until we were both exhausted from the intensity of the moment. "It's over, Annie. You're with me now. It's over." She had a bed already set up for me, an air mattress on the floor. She'd amassed a small collection of Nancy Drew books over the years since we parted, and they were waiting on my pillow. "I know you're too old for them now," she shrugged. "But every time I saw one, I thought of you. I thought you might want to catch up." That night, I was too wired to sleep or even to lie still on the little bed she'd prepared for me. I tossed and turned, and every time I even tried to close my eyes, I heard the door opening or the sound of his footsteps in the hall outside. I'd startle awake and begin the agitated cycle of fidgeting in my bed again. Late in the night, I heard a sound from Lexi's bed, and then she reached down and fumbled for my hand. I let her take it. Then the soft sound of her slightly out-of-tone singing filled the dorm room. "Twinkle, twinkle, little star, do you know how loved you are? In the morning, in the night, I'll love you with all my might." I was asleep before she even made it through the verse. I never told her about Robert, although I thought about it. I'd get all psyched up to confess what had really happened back at Winterton, but the words would stall and then die in my throat. She was so happy, positively thriving at college, and I was half terrified she'd blame herself for leaving me, and half terrified she'd blame me for letting him do it. Unlike Lexi, I left the community without a plan, and also, unlike Lexi, I immediately began to flounder. She had lived with Captain Edwards and his wife until she found her feet, all the while finishing high school and charting a course to med school. To support herself at college, she worked nights as a nursing assistant at a nursing home. She was a dorm leader on campus and she was tutoring. All of this was necessary to make ends meet without the added burden of her little sister in tow. Luckily, she managed to convince the dorm administrators to let me live with her for at least a few months while we figured out what to do. I'd been in the community for 6 years. I'd never been a teenager without the structure of the church. I didn't even know where to start. Lexi figured out the details and enrolled me at a high school, but I struggled from the very first class. I had no idea about basic science or how to structure an essay. Even my math skills were patchy because the church school paid lip service to state requirements for the girls' curriculum. After all, women were never allowed to work outside the home, or even to manage their own finances, so why learn algebra? "It was hard for me, too, at first," Lexi reassured me when I came home in tears the first day. "I'll help you study. You're smart, Annie. You can catch up." "But you at least got to do that accelerated science and math program," I sniffed. "And I don't have your wonder brain. I'm not a genius like you." "You just need to work a little bit harder till you catch up. You can do this, Annie." While academics were a struggle, they were nothing compared with the battle I faced socially. I had no idea how to interact with the other students, and just dealing with the crowds at the enormous high school was enough to leave me feeling a constant sense of panic. Whenever I was out of the classroom and on the busy grounds, or even in the cafeteria or school assemblies, I felt singled out. It was as though every person in the crowd knew my secret, that I was different and broken, and at any moment someone was going to point it out. Sometimes when I felt that panic, I'd find myself confused about where I was. Was I in the cafeteria or in the worship hall? Was it an ordinary lunch day, or was I being brought before the congregation to confess? I was on edge all of the time, and it was exhausting. During this adjustment period, Lexi had limitless energy for me, but her time was scarce. She was working so hard. I was just one of the many complicated balls she had to juggle. I was grateful to her, but I was feeling increasingly depressed, although I barely had the words to express the darkening storm clouds in my mind. I remained determined to make it work, though, and did my best to cope. I went to class as late as possible to avoid the crush in the halls, and ate lunch in an empty classroom alone. I read voraciously and figured out the essay thing, and was soon doing well again in English. But math and science were foreign languages that no one ever taught me to speak. By the second semester, I was skipping the classes I didn't enjoy. The upside was that one day, while I was hiding from my teachers, I found an unlikely group of friends. They were also outcasts, a small ragtag band of exceedingly dramatic kids with too much eyeliner and attitude. I didn't exactly join their group, but became friendly enough with one or two of them to learn some tips on how to blend in. Unsurprisingly, when the school year ended, I didn't have nearly enough credits to progress to sophomore year. Lexi was absolutely livid. Up until that point, I'd rarely seen her angry. "Don't you understand, Annie? School is everything. How could you hide this from me? You need to go back to school next year and sort this out. You'll redo your freshman year and make more of an effort this time." I'm smart. Not Lexi smart, but smart enough to have a level of self-awareness. Smart enough to understand that since I left the community, there have been two distinct parts to Annie Vidler. There is the regular, everyday me, and there is the bad me. The regular me runs on regular things and likes sappy movies and good books and golden sunsets. The regular me is a good friend and loves her sister and has quite a way with words. Then there is the bad me. It's the blackness. It's the darkness. And under it all is the pain. The bad Annie can be dormant for months at a time, but she is easily aroused. All it takes is an authoritative tone or demanding voice, or an accusation or a dismissive glance. It doesn't take a genius to figure out that bad me is fueled by my hatred for Robert. Understanding my pain does not mean I can control it. Lexi didn't even know about the bad me until she unwittingly unleashed her. All it took were those words and that tone. "Don't you understand, Annie? You have to make this work." And I was completely out of control. The rage rose from somewhere deep and dark within me, and once it was unleashed, its appetite for destruction wouldn't rest. We had a huge argument, and someone from an adjoining dorm room called campus security. When they came to check on us, I completely lost my mind. I don't remember doing it, but later Lexi told me that I smashed a hole in her door. That argument was the first time a tide of rage washed away my common sense. I was not going to be told what to do. I simply wasn't, not even by Lexi. She wasn't going to control me. No one was ever going to have the power to tell me how to live my life, not ever again. I was still blind with fury when they dragged me out of the dorm room, a seething ball of anger, kicking and screaming and cursing the guards and Lexi and the world. She followed, still trying to calm me, still trying to intervene, until a group of her friends pulled her away. I started to sober then, noticing at last the fear and the confusion in her eyes, but I didn't really snap out of my fit of rage until the campus police dumped me at the school gates and told me not to come back. Their dismissal was like a fire hose turned upon the heat of my anger. It was a shock to return to Earth only to realize that one mindless temper tantrum, and I had cost myself everything. I slept under a bridge that night, and the next day one of those sort of friends from school took me in. By the time I had cooled down enough to try to go back to the dorm, Lexi had been told I wasn't allowed to stay with her anymore. She still had 12 months to go on her undergrad degree, and now, because of me, we had nowhere to live. That was the first time I messed up Lexi's life.
21. Lexi. I've heard new parents say that the days go by too fast, but I'd never really understood what that meant before. The days between Daisy's birth and Annie's departure blur and blend, and I'm quickly confused about what day it is. We live extremes through every minute in that NICU. Within a few days of her birth, Daisy is caught in the full grip of withdrawal, and it's heart-wrenching to watch. She breaks out in a rash from head to toe, and she can't keep her milk down. Then she develops terrible diarrhea. She was born tiny on Monday morning, but by Thursday, she's lost 20% of her body weight, and there's talk about inserting an IV to maintain her hydration. Daisy has tremors. Her arms and legs and jaw vibrate furiously. And when it's at its worst, she gets a startled, petrified look in her eyes as if she's pleading with us to help her. Possibly worst of all, between her 3 hourly doses of morphine, Daisy cries that terrible cry, that distinct, agonized sound that NAS babies make, a sound so high-pitched it makes my ears ache. I can still hear it for hours after I leave the hospital each day. But because these things are all so intense, the peaceful moments, when they do come, are all the more blessed. Annie and I have long, quiet chats in that dark room in the NICU, and we talk about everything, and nothing much at all. We dissect every aspect of Daisy's face, looking for familiarities with Mom and Dad, and trying to find ourselves in her features. Sometimes we just sit in silence, and every now and again, we look away from the baby and smile at one another. Those moments of silent togetherness are precious to me, and I know they are to Annie, too. And when Daisy is resting, swaddled and held tight in Annie's arms or mine as we rock in the rocking chair, the easy rhythm of her breathing is like music to my ears. In those moments, I'm reminded that although this is a traumatic and dramatic way to start life, it will pass. The NICU doctors are playing with her morphine dosage, trying to keep it high enough to stave off the symptoms, but low enough that she's alert. The process takes time, but it's a well-established protocol, and Daisy's prognosis is excellent. I do try not to think much beyond the looming moment when I'll deliver my sister to the rehab center. I try not to think about how it will soon be me, alone in the rocking chair all day and as much of the night as I can manage. If I let myself think about it too much, it terrifies me. I've held human lives in my hands throughout my career and when I cared for Annie. But this is the first time I feel the weight of that responsibility. This is the first time I wonder if I'm up to the challenge. On Friday morning, I take a drive to the brand new rehab center in Auburn. This will be Annie's fourth stint in an inpatient rehab clinic, and I've brought the folder that has a record of all my previous efforts to get her help. I shake hands with Luke French, the director of the center. He is tall and strong, with piercing green eyes and receding hairline. Luke seems fatherly, and I can't tell if it's because of his gentle mannerisms or because he's a 50-something-year-old male who is entirely responsible for the lives of 40 addicts. "We have tried everything," I tell him. "But if she doesn't get clean this time, she will go to prison. She will lose her baby. She has to make this work." Luke links the fingers of his hands together on his desk as he stares at me. There is sadness and acceptance in his eyes. He is clearly someone who has been doing this for a long time. I'm not the first desperate family member to sit at his desk and plead with him for help, nor will I be the last. "I suspect that you know as well as I do that Annie needing to be sober will not guarantee her success here," he says softly. "Rock bottom is not something you can predict or prescribe. My experience is that addiction is always related to some disconnection, perceived or real, often rooted deep in some historical trauma. It takes an almost superhuman strength to overcome a narcotics addiction, because it takes an almost superhuman strength to look honestly at your past and yourself and ask, 'How can I heal?'" Our childhood was less than ideal, I say. I've tried to care for her in every way I knew how, but I don't think it was enough. We lost our dad very young, and we grew up in a strict religious sect. She has so many issues with authority.
Many addicts do, and every patient who comes through those doors has a complex story to unpack. We are well equipped to help her. We have a good success rate here, Alexis. I'm confident that if Annie wants to do the work, we can help her.
We review the folder together, and nothing he finds seems to shock Luke. He is steadfast and calm, and I'm reassured by that. Right up until the time comes for me to walk out of his office and return to the hospital. We shake hands, and then I realize that the next time I see him, I'll be handing Annie over into his care. I don't want her to be a number to this man. I want him to understand how special she is, how worthy she is of his best efforts. It's silly, because I'm a professional too, and I'm sure he's going to do his best, but... I stop in his doorway and I blurt, Luke, She's a good person. She deserves a better life. Luke offers me a weak smile.
I honestly believe that about every single person who comes through the doors of my clinic, Alexis. I promise you, I'll do everything I can for Annie.
22. Annie. Dear Luke, Lexi found us a rental a few blocks from her campus. It was a one-bedroom apartment, marginally larger than her dorm room, but somehow much less comfortable. The taps leaked, the heat rarely worked, and it was on the top floor of a four-floor walk-up. But it was all we could afford since I'd cost Lexi both her dorm job and the subsidized room that came with it. We moved into the new place a week before I started at community college. Lexi thought I might learn better in a more adult learning environment, so I was going to try to get a GED. Community college was my first foray into the adult world, and it was not at all like I expected. No one seemed to care if I wasn't doing the work. It was all up to me, but I found this motivating. My first semester's results were better than I expected, but at the same time, Lexi's ordinarily sky-high grades dipped a little. One night she came home from her second shift of the day at the nursing home, sat down at the dining room table where we both studied, and cleared her throat a few times. "What's wrong?" I asked her hesitantly. I could see that Lexi needed to give me bad news, which I dreaded, but worse still was the way that she looked at me. She was scared of my reaction, and that made me scared too. I was sure she was going to throw me out. I pictured her whispering miserably to me that she could no longer put up with me and my problems. Where would I go? Lexi was my whole world, but I could hardly blame her. I was the poison that tainted every good thing in her life. "I'm so sorry," she said eventually. "But you just have to get a job." I stared at her blankly. "A job? Just part-time around school. I can't keep working like this. But if you can bring in just a little income..." It had never even occurred to me that I should be trying to help Lexi financially. I was almost 16, though, definitely old enough to take on a part-time job between my classes, and I was happy to pull my weight. I managed to find a job serving fast food at the mall. I wasn't quite happy or settled during those years at community college, but I was no longer sad and lost. I was somewhere in the middle, in a state of perpetual okayness. What separated me from crossing over to a place where I actually felt content was the sense that it was all superficial, like the structure of my life was built on an empty foundation, and it would all crumble to dust at any second. Something was still missing, and when I started to think about my future and what I might like to do if I ever managed to get myself into a university, I'd feel a rush of fear from the thought that I might try and fail. Lexi was constantly encouraging me to make a plan. Charging toward a goal had always been her approach. I suppose that's why I was so shocked when she casually mentioned one evening that she'd been offered a spot at Johns Hopkins Medical School the following year, but she'd decided to defer. "I just need some downtime before I jump into it," she told me. "I'll take a gap year, work as much as I can,
and try to save up some money. Is this because I'm not done with my GED yet? I asked her, and she smiled at me. Don't be silly, Annie. It just makes sense for me to get some money saved first. Plus, I can help you study a bit now, and we can hang out some more. That'll be good, right? And it was good. We hung out all the time during the rest of that school year, mixing fun with sheer hard work. In between movie nights and chatting until the small hours about boys we knew or clothes or books, Lexi helped me study and pushed me to think about trying to get an undergrad degree after I finished my GED. We'd spend hours brainstorming the possibilities. And then, later in the year, Lexi drove me all over the place to check out campuses and go for admissions interviews. The idea of moving away from her was actually quite terrifying, but her optimism was addictive. Lexi screamed when I got the acceptance letter from Chicago State, and then she caught my wrists in hers, and she danced me around the tiny living area of our apartment, shrieking and laughing. She spun me around the room, and I felt that lightness that she'd drawn out of me that day on the lawn, the day of Dad's funeral. I started to laugh, and then I started to cry. And then I pulled away from her and reread the letter in case we'd both misread it somehow. You did it, Annie? Lexi was ready for another round of jubilant dancing, but I was rapidly unraveling from a confused sense of fear and relief. My leaky tears turned to sobs, and I pulled away from her and curled up in the corner of the couch. It was too much. I didn't deserve any of it. I was just taking the place of someone who did deserve to be at that school. I'd just mess it up. I'd fooled Lexi, and I'd fooled the admissions staff, and I'd somehow even fooled the graders on the GED. Didn't they realize I wasn't good enough for any of these opportunities? Lexi wrapped her arms around me, and she whispered into my ear. I'm so proud of you, Annie. I'm so excited for you. The world is your oyster. She seemed to assume that my tears were caused by relief, and I didn't have the words to explain how wrong she was. So I played along. I let her splurge on sparkling wine and pizza to celebrate, and all the while, the sense of dread grew inside me. Even at 18 years old, I had already figured out that the more you win at life, the more you have to lose.
23. Lexi. I'm shaking and nauseous when I arrive at the hospital to take Annie away from her baby. I know it's going to be ugly, but I also know it needs to be done. The court order states that she needs to be admitted to the inpatient program within 7 days of the baby's birth. Bernie tells me, as long as she's at the rehab clinic and the paperwork is completed by 5 p.m., she'll have met the requirement. Sam has taken the day off. He didn't ask before he did. He simply announced his plans at dinner last night. I'm going to drive you two up to Auburn, he said, and I couldn't even convince myself to protest. I don't need a chauffeur or a bodyguard. I'm plenty capable of handling this all by myself. But it's over an hour back to our place, and I can't bear the thought of saying goodbye to Annie and making that drive back home alone. So I thanked Sam quietly, and now I feel compelled to thank him again before we step inside the NICU. I'm so glad you're going to be here, I tell him. Good, he says simply. I have to admit, it was worrying me a bit, the way you kept trying to deal with all of this on your own. We need to be a team in times like this, right? Right, I say resolutely. And then Sam links his hand through mine, and we walk through the door into the hospital. We spend the day wandering in and out of the NICU and Annie's room. We give her several hours alone with the baby, and then Sam and I sit with her for several more. Annie cries a lot, and I cry too, because all of it's unfair. It's unfair that Daisy is still so sick. It's unfair that Annie hasn't been here long enough to see her improve. It's unfair that Annie has to put the baby through all of this in the first place. And then it's incredibly unfair when 3 p.m. ticks around. Come on, love. We need to get going. Annie holds Daisy close to her face and her tears rise again, quickly escalating into heartbreaking sobs that rack her entire body. She shudders and she wails and she weeps so hard that the NICU nurse asks us if we need a doctor to order a sedative.
She can't go into rehab sedated, Sam whispers pointedly to the nurse, who grimaces and shrugs. I don't know how you're going to get her away from that kid.